Okay, so I'll continue the readings during the time that Ajahn Amaro is in his period of retreat for 3 weeks. And he suggested I continue to read from the island, but do the chapters that I had written. We collaborated on this book, but we took two different areas and took responsibility for each area on our own. Of course, we're consulting back and forth all the time, but the actual writing and collating the different material was around different themes. I picked up on the themes of practices and perspectives on Nibbana, practices for leading to the experience of Nibbana, and then perspectives and ways of viewing both the practice and the goal. Then the last few chapters that I wrote were on the Sotapanna, or the stream entry experience, just as the first sort of introduction to the experience of Nibbana. I will read my preface. It's about two-thirds the length of Ajahn Amaro's, which is about the case each time. So I wrote, having been a person who has enjoyed reading books, my involvement in the production of this volume has instilled in me a much greater appreciation for those who do write books. When the end of suffering, Nibbana, is the topic, one would think the writing about it would be less suffering. Curious how some things are not as they appear. Yeah, as I said, I would just enjoy reading books, but then you realize, oh, it's a lot more difficult to write a book than it is to read a book. So, and the book did take us 10 years to write. It was, we pulled together a manuscript, went over it ourselves, read it out to the community, got a bunch of feedback, went back and worked on the manuscript, did that process again, until we were finally comfortable with the material and how it felt. Yeah, it took about 10 years to really get it to a place where we were comfortable to put it out to the public. My involvement with this began with my jotting down a variety of sutta quotes which I'd come across in my readings, which I found inspiring and which also, for me, helped to clarify the direct and immediate path of the Buddha. Mostly they were things that I found helpful in my own practice, and it was good to have them in one place for me to read from time to time. I really did start with just writing stuff down, as I still do. I've got, although I don't write down it on paper anymore, it's all on my phone. But there's all sorts of quotes and references and whatnot, because it is helpful to go back to different aspects of the practice and reflect on them over and over and over again. It's just the nature of the practice and the training that you can read something and it makes sense, but you've got to keep reflecting on it and have it to hand to think through it pretty clearly. And there was also a question in my own mind about the interest in the West concerning non-dual teachings, both within the Buddhist fold and outside it. When coming across passages that people were quoting, I found it striking how seldom that the words of the Buddha were being used to illustrate this. That is, these very non-dual teachings. Most were, some New Agey stuff or Advaita Vedanta teachings, and not so much direct quotes from the Buddha, which I was puzzled by. By slowly reflecting on various suttas which cropped up as interesting or striking, the nature of what is considered non-dual for me started to change. Basic teachings started to take on new meaning. The teaching of non-self, which is totally fundamental, that is fundamental to the Buddhist path, is an example. It's not an obscure teaching in the suttas. If there is any hint of self, a position is then taken, and the whole realm of samsara unfolds. That's the, you know, in terms of duality of self and other, it's just such a an aspect of what the function of delusion is. And the Buddha is just constantly pointing to that all the time. And I think the Buddha's approach is one that is very direct and tangible. The Buddha points this out in many ways, both in detail and quite pithy discourses. Teaching on dependent origination is another example. It can get very complex and heady, but in essence, this is a description of the Buddha's enlightenment and of a way of viewing phenomena, which takes us away from the narrative that we easily create, showing that experience is just these mental and physical conditions functioning together in a certain pattern, either for freedom or for entanglement. So that sense of like dependent origination, Ajahn Amaro has been pointing to in his recent readings, that's stepping out of the narrative of self and going directly to experience. And as soon as you step out of the narrative of self, then you have already given yourself the opportunity to drop a huge amount of suffering and the what would be considered non-dual. Generally, it is stated that the Buddha did not teach much about Nibbana, that he focused more on the path of practice and left it to us to figure it out for ourselves, if we followed the path correctly. On a certain level, this may be true, but as this compilation shows, the Buddha did say a great deal about Nibbana. A large part of the motivation to help bring this book into being was to gather together quotes of the Buddha's own words from the discourses which helped to illustrate and hopefully clarify the Buddha's teachings, in particular those about the goal, Nibbana. We are, in a way, taking the opportunity to bring out jewels and treasures from a cave or a hidden place and allowing them to shine forth. Ideally, this is an opportunity to gather the words of the Buddha on a particular theme together into one place for people to delight in. Hopefully the editors have not got in the way too much and the Buddha's words and path are left clear. I do want to express my appreciation for all the many people who have helped to make this book become a reality, particularly Ajahn Amaro, who gently kept prodding me and was patient with my pace or lack of it, which is, it's easy to become a procrastinator. And Ajahn Amaro is just such a diligent when it comes to books and literary things. He's on the case all the time, and sometimes I would just have so much resistance and take me a while to get going, and he kept prodding me. I think of procrastination, because I used to get on Ajahn Jayasaro's case with trying to get him to get the Stillness Flowing, the biography of Ajahn Chah, and that took him 20 years, to really get it together. And I remember him one time saying, he says, you have to remember that, I'm I used to be an amateur procrastinator, and now I'm a pro. At the beginning of the book, there was a dedication, which I wrote, and then Ajahn Amaro thought, "Oh, that's good." But anyway, the book was dedicated to Lumpa Cha, whose selflessness and wisdom was able to transform disparate, wandering characters into dedicated seekers of truth, and that was certainly the case in the early days of, all the way through Ajahn Cha's teaching career. Like nowadays, people who show up at Watnana Chat or show up at our monasteries in the West now, you know, actually have an interest in Buddhism and some knowledge, which is a big deal. Whereas, like in my era, and you know, and Ajahn Amaro's as well, you know, we showed up at Wat Mapong or Watnana Chat with basically no working knowledge of Buddhism, Buddhist practice, meditation. Nobody really knew what the heck they were getting themselves into. And Ajahn Chah kind of accepted us and helped guide us and transformed us, really. So it was really quite a feat of his wisdom and patience. And then also dedication to Lumpo Semedo, whose unselfish altruism and perseverance has so successfully transplanted a branch of the Sangha in the West. And, that's really, it's hard to underestimate the impact that Ajahn Sumedho, Lumpo Sumedho, has had on Buddhism in the West. Being able to have this place that you all have here is really due to his willingness to give himself to the teaching and to leading people. And, it's not easy to transplant something from a traditional culture and bring it into a completely different culture. And Lumpo Sumedho was able to manifest that. And it's really something. And I remember one time at Ajahn Chah saying, it was like the very first time that Lumpo Sumedho came back to visit Thailand. I think he'd been away for 5 years, because Ajahn Chah, when he left Ajahn Sumedho here in England the very first time, said, don't come back for 5 years. So as soon as 5 years was up, he came back for a visit and brought a few of the monastics and a group of lay people. And I remember one time, they were staying up at a branch monastery that both Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho really loved, Tham Sang Phet. It's kind of this standalone mountain and about an hour and a half north of Wat Pa Pong. And that's about 1,000 acres of forest land and hills. And Ajahn Chah said, you guys don't know how much of a debt of gratitude you owe to Ajahn Sumedho. He said, he's been the tank that's broken the way for all of you guys. Or he's like the bulldozer who's pushed the way in front and cleared out a path for the rest of you. So it was really a really lovely tribute, praise. And the effect of the integrity of both of these lives, that is, Lumpo Cha and Lumpo Sumedho, the effect of the integrity of both these lives is difficult to imagine, but it is likely that Lumpo Cha would be happy to see the results as they are today. May their examples be a source of inspiration to us all long into the future. So that was part of the dedication for acknowledgement of this book as a tribute to the teachers that went before us. I thought before I got into reading my part from the island, I would take a digression into the Buddha's own description of his search for Nibbana, which is, the sutta is Majjhima 26, Arya Pariyasana Sutta, which is the noble search, the Buddha's search for liberation, for awakening. It's quite a long sutta. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read substantial chunks of it because it opens a window onto his motivation and his experience. But it also opens a window into the life of the Buddha and his relationship with his disciples around him, and you get a feel. Getting a feel for the mayu of the time of the Buddha, and then the Buddha recollecting his own experience of practice and training. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Savatthi for alms. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, Friend Ananda, it is long since we heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could get to hear such a talk, Friend Ananda. Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. Yes, friend, they replied. So that, you can see that the Buddha, obviously sometimes he just let people practice and be and not be teaching all the time. Other times he would be, be quite diligent in teaching. And so probably, it went in cycles. I'm reminded of a story about one of Ajahn Chah's teachers, Ajahn Tonglen. And the story was told by Lokta Mahabua, a very eminent monk, disciple of Ajahn Mun. And similarly, sometimes he'd be diligent teaching, and sometimes he would just be willing to practice on his own and just let people go to the practice. And anyway, Ajahn Mahabua was Lumpu Mun's attendant at the time. And then Ajahn Tonglen came along. He was quite well known as being very energetic, kind of audacious, kind of eccentric. And but anyway, he was there with Ajahn Mun at the time, living together. And Ajahn Mun ran a pretty tight ship. He was always pretty fierce with his student and kept trying to get them to be restrained and diligent in their practice. And but anyway, it was just going through a period where he wasn't teaching so much. And then Ajahn Tonglen was getting a bit missing Ajahn Mun's teachings. So he went down to Ajahn Mun's kuti, and Ajahn Mahabua was there. Ajahn Mun was up above in the room, and there's down below, it's just an open space down below, and there's places for receiving visitors and whatnot, and or spending time down below, especially in the hot season. And Ajahn Tonglen started sort of banging things and tipping stuff over, and Ajahn Mahabua sort of, stop, what are you doing? Ajahn Mun's upstairs, and he's stop. And then Ajahn Tonglen just kept making kind of a bit of a racket and being really clumsy, and Ajahn Tonglen said, he hasn't taught for a long time, we've got to get him going. And Ajahn Mahabua, when he's telling the story, he says, for me, I felt like my liver was shriveling up. I was so frightened. I was so scared. And Ajahn Tonglen is just making this racket. And then he leaves. And I'm down there with him. Sure enough, then, that afternoon, Ajahn Mun told Ajahn Mahabua, call the monks together for a meeting. So they had this meeting, and Ajahn Mun gave this blistering talk about how, proper deportment and proper practice and proper training. And Ajahn Mahabua, he was sitting there, and whereas Ajahn Tonglen, a big smile on his face, he got Ajahn Mun going again. So anyway, it looked like the Buddha was in a similar style. Then, when the Blessed One had wandered for alms in Savatthi and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, let us go to the eastern park, to the palace of Megara's mother, for the day's abiding. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern park, the palace of Megara's mother, for the day's abiding. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern bathing place to bathe. When he was finished, he came up out of the water and stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. That hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion. The Blessed One consented in silence. Then the Blessed One went to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were sitting together in the hermitage discussing the Dhamma. The Blessed One stood outside the door waiting for their discussion to end. When he knew that it was over, he coughed and knocked, and the bhikkhus opened the door for him. The Blessed One entered, sat down on a seat made ready, and addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you seated together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" "Venerable Sir, our discussion on the Dhamma that was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself. Then the Blessed One arrived." "Good, bhikkhus, it is fitting for you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from home life into homelessness to sit together to discuss the Dhamma. When you gather together, bhikkhus, you should do either of two things, hold discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence." So just, again, a sort of that sense of the Buddha's life or the life in the time of the Buddha. This is a very ordinary kind of scenario, but it, to me, is very touching, really. And, of course, Ananda, out of his both knowledge of the Buddha's character and his own willingness to help people, just sort of setting up an occasion that the Buddha could be teaching the, whether as monks or lay people, there's many, many occasions where Ananda is facilitating that. "Bhikkhus, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here someone being himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. And what may be said to be subject to birth? Wife and children are subject to birth. Men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to birth. These acquisitions are subject to birth, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth." So that sense of an ignoble search. You spend your time, put your time and your energy looking for things that are subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, and defile. That is, it's kind of fruitless. And when he says these acquisitions, the word is upadhi, and the root meaning of upadhi means foundation, basis, ground. Because it's also, upadhi is also the, in a description of Nibbana, it is the relinquishment of all acquisitions. So that acquisitions can mean, yeah, wife and children, men and women, slaves, goats and fowl, all of the gold and silver. Material things in the world are acquisitions, but also the acquisition of identity, the acquisition of the sense of identifying with the five khandhas, with form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. That is an acquisition. And part of the description of the realization of Nibbana is that it is a relinquishing of all acquisition. So it's not just giving up one's money and position in society. It's also giving up identification with this body and mind complex. It's an important term to be reflecting on, and it has that whole range of connotation in the word acquisition. And what may be said to be subject to aging, and same thing, all of the same things, sheep, fowl, pigs, elephants, gold and silver. And same with this subject to sickness, subject to death, subject to sorrow, subject to defilement, all of these things. These acquisitions are subject to defilement, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to defilement, or sorrow, or death, or sickness, seeks what is also subject to those things. This is the ignoble search. And what is the noble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. This is the noble search. So that sense of the understanding, the limitation or the danger, adinava, is something that the Buddha uses as the danger, it's the limitation, the drawback of something. There's several different ways that the Buddha describes his own awakening. Sometimes he'll describe it in terms of the Four Noble Truths are the most common. It wasn't until I saw these Four Noble Truths and their 12 aspects that I declared my full awakening, or dependent origination. But another aspect of the Buddha describing his awakening is seeing the benefit, seeing the drawback, seeing the way out or the escape of this different realms of our experience. From this sense, seeing the danger in what is subject to birth, subject to aging, subject to death, subject to sickness, subject to sorrow, subject to defilement. So the seeing the danger, it's one of the doorways into realization, so that one can relinquish. Any questions so far? Comments? Yeah.
Yesterday you also mentioned something. You said that letting go, relinquishing identification is actually the real security. Would you expand a little bit on that?
In the sense that as long as we're identified with anything that is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, those growth and change and decay, then we're going to be disappointed because of, so this is where the aspects of dukkha come in, and as that sense, even just the limitations of things, you experience a sense of dukkha, or even in that which is pleasant and delightful, but we're attached to it, it has to end, so we experience dukkha, or the dukkha of being identified with something that is compounded, that arises and ceases, then there's always going to be the separation, or there's the difficulty of its inherent stress within it, something being compounded, even if it's pleasant. So that the relinquishment, the letting go, is the way out. And especially on identity, the mind identifying, this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. That is a good recipe for dukkha. So it continues, Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, While I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Suppose that, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth, bhikkhus, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, Alara Kalama is a teacher at the time of the Buddha. In some of the descriptions of the Buddha's renunciation or going forth, he sneaks out of the palace and disappears. But obviously, say, in this description, the Buddha says, yeah, my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces. That sense of there's been some discussion and communication with his family about what he's thinking, what he's feeling. But he's intent on seeking liberation. So I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, Friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Alara Kalama replied, The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see. And there were others who did likewise. I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares. By realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. So that's a meditative attainment of the formless forms of concentration and a very refined state of realization and ability to bring the mind to a place of stillness and peace. So, but then the Buddha says, I considered, not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So he realized the same, able to realize that same level of stillness within the mind. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalami, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So the Buddha is saying, I've realized exactly the same experience or realization. And then Alara Kalama replies, It is a gain for us, friend, it is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that I declare, I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself. You also enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. Thus Alarakalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So the Buddha was in this sense of his noble search. The Buddha is really looking for a complete liberation. He's not looking just for a peaceful abiding. He wants complete freedom. So I think that's important that they, especially for ourselves, you know, what are we willing to be satisfied with? And I think it's important to keep motivating ourselves. How do we be free from dukkha? How are we completely free of the entanglements of the mind that seeks dependence and acquisition of identity? The Buddha is setting the example. Any questions there?
It strikes me as interesting that, I mean, even before he leaves the home, he has this strong sense that Nibbana is possible. It seems strange where he gets this such a strong confidence there.
Yeah, there are places where the Buddha also says, there's this which is born, surely there must be an unborn. There's this which is not peaceful and is entangled, surely there is that which is peaceful and unentangled. So it's like he's just using logic. And having this confidence, there is this birth, aging, sickness, death. Surely there must be something that is not subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. It's a logical inference in the beginning, but then, of course, that's what his, awakening experience is, a confirmation of that intuition and that motivation to find that which is beyond the ordinary and the mundane. So the Buddha is quite exceptional in the history of religious tradition. Of course I'm biased, but to feel that the Buddha is really willing to push himself beyond the comfort level of putting up with what is basically bearable. I mean, it's kind of like Freud, for all his insight into the nature of mind in the, 19th century. He basically felt that, what his teaching could do would get you to, a basic level of human suffering. Free you from some things, but it would get you to a sort of ordinary, normal level of suffering. And the Buddha wouldn't settle for that. Because the same thing happens with another teacher, Uddaka Ramaputta, and he realizes another level of the refinement, being able to enter into the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And it's like these are like seventh and eighth level of the formless realms. So exceptionally refined. But he's not satisfied with it and continues, still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvela in Senanigamma. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground, this is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. So this would be, say, in the story of the Buddha. There's no place in canon where there's a chronological timeline where everything is laid out. It just doesn't happen. You pick up the different pieces of the puzzle. Whether at this point he starts embarking on his ascetic practices, and then the five ascetics who practice with him come and train with him at this point, or he's already sort of given up the sort of ascetic practices and the five ascetics have abandoned him, that's not at all mentioned in this. Certainly there's other suttas where, I think, Mahasatyaka Sutta, Majjhima 36, where the Buddha details a lot of the ascetic practices that he underwent. The different narratives have to be patched together to get a general picture. But this is one particular narrative that the Buddha is giving of his, say, his life story and his aspiration. And, of course, under the theme of the noble search. And then he just all of a sudden says, then bhikkhus, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. So all of a sudden it leaps to the fact that here he is, he is realization. So as I say, one has to rely on some of these anthologies where these different suttas are pulled together into one place that you get a full description of the Buddha's practice, the story of his life, or in the beginnings of his teachings. So this is one particular angle on it. Being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, defilement, then he's, I attain the undefiled supreme security from bondage. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. And then this is where, in this sutta, then the Buddha is starting to reflect on the nature of his awakening. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely, specific conditionality. That's paticca samuppada. Because Ajahn Amaro has been focusing on these last days, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. And this is where the Buddha is describing this truth of realization, and part of it is that relinquishing of all acquisitions. The stilling of all formation, sambhasankara samatha, bringing to tranquility all the different formations and things of a created form, relinquishing of all acquisitions, sabbupati, apatinisaka, destruction of craving, tanhakaya, dispassion, vilaga, niloda, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Thereupon, there came to me spontaneously these stanzas never heard before. And I sort of, okay, enough with teaching. What's the point of teaching? And then, of course, considering this, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. And then this is where the story of the Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind, the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish. And so then the Brahma Sahampati comes and invites the Buddha to teach. There will be those with little dust in their eyes. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. And that's where the Brahmajaloka Vipatipasampadi. This is the invitation for a Dhamma talk that is recited for the invitation. That is where this comes from. So it says, then I listened to the Brahma's pleading, and out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelt seeing fear and blame in the other world. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water, thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water, rest on the water's surface, and some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water, rise out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it. So too, surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, and some who dwelt seeing fear and blame in the other world. Then I replied to the Brahma Sahampati in stanzas, open for them are the doors to the deathless, let those with ears now show their faith. And this is the verse that Ajahn Sumedho recites more often than not. When aparuta tesan amatasa dohar davara ye soda vantu pamunchintang sadang. That's Ajahn Sumedho is partial to that. So thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not speak the Dhamma, subtle and sublime. Then the Brahma Sahampati thought, the Blessed One has consented to my request, and after paying homage to me, keeping me on the right, he thereupon departed at once. It's 7 o'clock. I'm not through this sutta yet. But it's close. Any questions? Comments quick before
I've never quite understood what seeing fear and blame in the other world refers to.
Rebirth. That's what I take it as. You know, seeing fear and blame in rebirth, being in the cycle of birth and death, of taking rebirth in another form, so way, shape, or form, some other being, even in a Brahma realm.
So those seeing fear and blame would be interested in the teachings is his.
Yeah, if you see the blame in that, or see that you have some fear around it, so okay, I want out. Okay.